Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, The Limits of Masculinity. We'll spend this hour with author and social change advocate Sarah Rich, who says we live in a world with so few positive variations on what a real man can look like that boys are forced to give up all that lies outside the norms of boyhood. We'll talk about how gender roles came to be and unpack the ways masculinity doesn't just put down women, but actually suppresses the self-expression of boys and men. And we'll talk about how reshaping masculinity can benefit all genders. Our conversation starts after a short break. Wears pants, likes the color blue, or plays with trains, we are unfazed. Maybe she's a tomboy or just sporty. When a boy wears a dress, though, or likes pink or begs for ballet lessons, he is often teased or shamed. Whether intentional or not, we almost immediately question his masculinity. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. From birth, boys are set on a predetermined path to manhood, one that forces them to let go of the parts of themselves that are considered feminine, or else risk harassment or exclusion from the male gender group. Sarah Rich is a writer and editor. Her most recent article for The Atlantic is called Today's Masculinity is Stifling, and she joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco to talk about it. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you begin your article by talking about your young son, preschool aged, heading to school in a dress. And I was really interested in how you said he kind of quietly had planned this for a long time. What do you mean by that?
Well, he for a long time was interested in wearing dresses, or he has a mermaid costume that he loves. He would wear them everywhere but at school. He loved to wear them at home. He would wear them when he got home from school. And that was fine. And, you know, we didn't forbid wearing them to school, but he never expressed a desire to do so. And in fact, definitely made clear that that was a place where he didn't feel he wanted to wear them. And then little by little, he started wearing them to sleep. And then one day he slept in a dress, which he'd been doing for a while. And when he woke up in the morning, I brought out the clothes he would have normally worn, which was like a pair of leggings and a T-shirt. And he said, "I'm already dressed." And I said, "Are you sure?" Because he'd been really sure that wasn't what he wanted. And he was sure. And he marched to school in a dress. And so I felt as though he had been thinking it over. You know, he hadn't been discussing it really with us, but it was clear, even this little four-year-old person, we often think, you know, I think often we don't expect that kids can be deeply reflective in that way, but it seemed to me he really sort of thought this through and did it when he was ready.
And as you were walking, didn't he kind of toss out confidently, "Some people are going to say I shouldn't be wearing this. I'm ready for it."
He did. Yeah. He said to me, "You know, people are going to tell me I shouldn't be wearing a dress." And I said, "Yes, they probably will." And, it was a way, I think, for him to show I know what's coming and I think that I'm ready.
And as a mom, I mean, how did you feel as you made that walk across the blacktop and into the front door, knowing that this was going to change the way some people perceived him? How did you feel?
I felt a little nervous. I felt a little concerned that the blowback was going to be stronger than he anticipated, or that someone would say something really cutting. You know, kids can be sensitive and kids can be cruel. And I worried for him, and I worried a little bit. You know, I felt a little self-conscious as we walked to the school. We live in Oakland. It's a very liberal, open-minded place, and the school we go to is that way as well. But nevertheless, I felt a little conscious, you know, with this little boy in his rainbow unicorn dress. So I worried a little about what people might think, but it went pretty well.
And that's what I was going to ask. How did people react?
As soon as he got in the classroom, I kind of peeked in the door as he went in. And this was already well into his school year, so he was comfortable, you know, with his teachers and his friends. And a little girl did say, "Why are you wearing that? You know, boys shouldn't wear dresses." And I kind of waited to see how he was going to react. And the teacher was sitting right there, and she sort of, you know, gently told this child that wasn't an appropriate thing to say. And she gave my son a squeeze, and he didn't look at me, and he didn't look too worried. And so I left, and I had brought, you know, alternate clothes for him in case he changed his mind. So I put them in his little cubby as I left and figured if he decided he didn't want to stay in the dress, he'd have an option. But when I came to get him in the afternoon, he was still wearing the dress. And he said, you know, some people said this and that to me, but he didn't seem too troubled. And it did, you know, it continued. This was sort of like the breaking of the seal. He then wore dresses. He's worn dresses most days since that time. And there was still, you know, people made some comments. Every once in a while, he would say, kind of out of the blue, we'd be driving in the car, and he'd say, you know, so-and-so was mean to me. And I'd ask, well, what did they say? And usually it was, boys shouldn't wear dresses or something along those lines. But he never really seemed deeply affected by it, and it didn't change his desire to do that. And now, I mean, I think most, it's not a huge school. I think most people in the school kind of know that's his thing. And, you know, nobody gives him a hard time.
And there was a lovely little moment in there. I think one day at drop off when your husband dropped off your little boy, he heard like a little ally in the class mm-hmm. stand up for him. What did she say?
She said to another child who had said something about, you know, he shouldn't have the dress, or maybe it was something more specific. But this little girl said, boys can like beautiful things, too, which was striking for us both, because she didn't say boys can wear dresses. She said boys can like beautiful things. And the idea that that's something that they would have to argue for, you know, that beauty is only reserved for girls to enjoy or appreciate or exhibit, really is, I mean, that's kind of remarkable, but it's not untrue.
So where did today's gender models for male and female come from? I know that's a big question, but how would you start the answer to that question?
Oh, I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, reasonable historic structures and causes for why gender roles and norms exist. You know, there have been times in history, whether for cultural reasons or by necessity, men and women did different things in society, and or they wore different clothes, or, you know, a number of different things. I mean, there are you can look back in time and you can see kind of structural reasons why these things were true. I think what we're dealing with right now is the fact that many of those kind of deeper forces have either gone away or have at least shifted, and yet there are a lot of these traditional norms that are still enforced on little kids. And I think if you pick those apart, you start to see that a lot of them no longer necessarily make sense. And indeed, many of them are damaging. And I do think there's damage on both sides for, you know, obviously boys and girls, men and women. But I think we've spent a bit more time recently focused on the damage falling towards women. And I think there's real damage starting at a young age for boys when they're forced into these norms.
Why do you think we're so much more aware of and quick to police, you know, perceived violations of masculinity?
Well, I mean, what I got at in my piece, and I think is very true, is that it's kind of complicated to get through it, but, you know, it's still true in a lot of ways that masculinity is valued above femininity, that men are societally rewarded more, you know, validated more for whatever qualities they may have. Men tend to have more power, more status, they're paid more, you know, they're viewed as stronger. And so I think whether we know it or not, there's really a widespread kind of acceptance that these things are valued more highly. And you mentioned that when you began, as far as, you know, when girls exhibit masculine qualities, whether it's just simply wearing pants or being into, you know, contact sports or whatever, they're applauded. I mean, we are telling girls you should be strong, you should be brave, you should be courageous, and that's the way to have a more powerful position in the world and to be, you know, higher status, all these things. So I think what happens is when a boy goes outside of those characteristics, in a way, what we're saying is you're leaning towards the inferior qualities, the societally inferior qualities. You're going towards, you know, what often are viewed as weaker, softer, less powerful ways of being in the world. And that makes people uncomfortable, because why wouldn't we want all our children to pursue, you know, the stronger traits, but really it's symbolic of the fact that we still have a lot to sort out about how we categorize these characteristics and whether they're categorized by gender or in some other way.
So basically the history of gender inequality for women kind of reinforces the categories that we, the boxes that we still live inside of?
Yeah, I think that's true.
So outside of traffic accidents, suicide is the leading cause of death for boys. How is this related to masculinity in adolescence?
Well, there's quite a bit of research I mentioned. There's a really good documentary I mentioned called The Mask You Live In that also looks at some of this research and looks at boys specifically connecting, you know, suicide, violence, and mental health struggles with the ways in which boys are steered into these narrow boxes of masculine norms. They're at a, you know, say prior to adolescence, when boys are starting to sort out their identities, all kids are starting to sort out their identities and figure out what they are and what they're not and what gender means, and among many other things. You know, part of, we started out talking about boys wearing dresses, and of course that's a very externally obvious sign of a boy bucking the norms. But there are other things that are more subtle and internal, like, you know, expressing emotion, you know, crying, obviously, intimate relationships, communication that's based in emotion, things like this that kids naturally tend to have as a part of their relationships and part of their friendships. I mean, all people do. But as kids, as boys enter adolescence, a lot of the time, as they start to be told, this is what a boy is, this is what a man is, some of those things actually get shut out of what they're allowed to consider theirs. And boys start to let go of the intimacy and open communication and emotional expression that characterize relationships for them. And it can be a very isolating experience. And so there are stories, there is evidence to show that that isolation can lead to mental health struggles, can lead to violence, and can lead to depression, anxiety, suicide. I mean, a lot of pretty serious consequences.
Do we start to narrow kind of the scope of what's acceptable within boyhood pretty early? I mean, this is not something that happens later in life. Does it start out very narrow for boys?
Yes. Yes, it does. I think it starts out earlier than we think. I mean, from what I've seen, you know, there are increasingly programs and efforts to allow boys to sort of examine what masculinity means. But a lot of those do start in adolescence and teenage years. And you know, my personal experience is with a very little boy. He's almost five now. But I feel like I started noticing this in the like 3.5 to 4 range, you know, in preschool, because their worlds start to expand and they start to take cues from all over the place. And one of the big ones, really, I mean, of course, our families and communities and teachers and friends are a big influence. But another really big one is consumer culture. I mean, kids are so influenced by you know, their toys and their lunchboxes and clothing, of course, and movies and TV, and all of these things are very coded by gender. And, you know, of course, parents, whether consciously or not, tend to often choose items for their kids based on that. Most parents don't walk into a Target or a Walmart and, you know, pick a pink princess lunchbox for their little boy if their little boy hasn't expressed a strong preference for that. And even if they have, sometimes, you know, it's not, it's like the world around us is telling us this is what you should choose for your child based on their sex. And so it starts very young, and then kids pick up on those differences and they start to point them out. And, you know, that's how it begins.
And it seems to me, as a parent also of a four-year-old, that toys seem more gendered now than they were when I was younger in the 80s. I feel like there was more neutral stuff then than there is now. Everything's in a set for boys or a set for girls.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that is true. I spoke with a really great researcher named Elizabeth Sweet, who has done a tremendous amount of research looking specifically at toy catalogs across the 20th century. And her research definitely did show that we're in a more gender-coded time than we've ever been in terms of toys. There have been eras, you know, I talked with her about sort of the 50s being pretty gendered, and then there was this sort of like, you know, move towards more gender neutrality in the 70s and the 80s, and then it has come back. And now, it's true, they're very coded. You know, some of the stores like Target are making an effort to remove some of those signifiers based on consumer demand. But nevertheless, each toy is packaged based on color and all of these things. So yes, it is very gendered.
My guest this hour is Sarah Rich. Her article appears in The Atlantic. It's called Today's Masculinity is Stifling. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372, and we'll be back with more in just a couple of minutes.
The three most destructive words that every man receives when he's a boy is when he's told to be a man.
I had anger issues in high school. I felt like an outcast.
I've been suspended at least once every year I was here.
We would just look for trouble and just like try to fight.
I felt like just giving up on life. You know, I just had suicide thoughts in my head at sixth grade.
I felt alone for a long time, and I actually thought about killing myself.
If you're told from day one, don't let nobody disrespect you, and this is the way you handle it as a man, respect is linked to violence.
If I can man up, why step down from that? You feel me?
It's like instinct.
That's a clip from the 2014 documentary, The Mask You Live In, which explores how American masculinity is harming boys. Our guest this hour is Sarah Rich, who wrote a piece for The Atlantic called Today's Masculinity is Stifling. Sarah, you mentioned the documentary in this conversation, as well as in your piece for The Atlantic. When you hear those voices kind of all strung together, I mean, what does that say to you about what we are projecting that being a man or being a boy is?
Well, I mean, it's pretty chilling to listen to those voices. I think, you know, there's no question we're dealing right now culturally with a very serious problem as far as how many adult men have been behaving, whether you're looking at gun violence, you know, in the case of many of the mass shootings or sexual assault. You know, there are, I think, of the things you just played, I mean, I think a big one is the relationship that person is drawing between being respected and being violent, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're told that this is the set of ways that you're going to earn respect in the world and being respected is very important, then if you're not feeling that you're being respected, to act out violently, to, you know, to be aggressive, to demonstrate your physical strength is a way of dealing with that. I mean, that message is still pretty widely projected at boys, and it sounds there's a logic to it in a way, in the way that it's currently being conveyed, but it's obviously deeply problematic.
Do you think adolescence is a time that people really kind of start adopting and inhabiting these gender categories? Is that because of either hormonal shifts or just self-awareness? Is that when it gets a little bit troubling and worrisome?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think before adolescence is when kids are just figuring out difference and figuring out their identity. I mean, part of, I think, sorting out identity is defining what you think that you are and what you think that you're not, right? And I think that starts to become clear. A child starts to recognize that they can signify that. They aren't just going to be told, oh, you seem like this or you seem like that, but they're going to figure out ways to project to their communities and to the world, this is what I am. And so I think as there are obviously hormonal and biological components to the ways that kids start to identify their sex and their gender and their sexuality. But a lot of it has to do with what somebody wants to project. And that carries all the way through our lives. We have the option to choose how we communicate who we are. So, but I think that a big, you know, another one of those kids speaking in that video is talking about the feeling of isolation. You know, I think obviously no kid, being a teenager is hard. Being an adolescent is hard. No kid wants to feel like they're an outcast. No kid wants to feel like they're not being included. And so if you get a sense that, okay, these are the things I can do to avoid that experience, then of course, you know, most kids are going to want to do that because it doesn't feel good to be rejected from your community group.
Let's take a call now from Bruce in Carrollton. Bruce, you can go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I was wondering what roles do religion play in the rigidity of gender norms? I know from my own experiences that in like India, Polynesia, or other indigenous cultures, there's no issue with boys wearing traditional skirts or even holding hands. Only like when the missionaries came, that kind of influenced culture to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So can we trace that? I mean, does religion influence or reinforce gender roles?
I mean, I don't think I can speak really broadly to this in any very deep way, but I mean, certainly my article is about American cultural experience. And I think the two things come up in hearing that question. I mean, one is, yes, there are other cultures now and in the past where boys wear, you know, tunic-like things or even long, you know, long dresses, adult men as well, wear things that look like skirts and dresses and tunics in our, you know, sort of fashion language. And that's just part of the dress. It's not considered feminine. Same with, you know, having your two men with their arms around each other or holding hands and those types of expression. I mean, it's not true everywhere in the world that those are outside the bounds of masculine behavior. But within the American context, you know, how religion plays in, I mean, I think that there are definitely certain norms and behaviors that are considered to fall within the guidelines of certain religious traditions. And so I think depending what religion you're talking about and how those religions play into kind of broader cultural expectations. I mean, yes, the way people are going to think that this should go is going to vary based on lots of things, including religion.
We talked a little bit before the break about kind of gendered toys and how early we're kind of sorting kids into different boxes and dressing different ways and playing with different playthings. You bring something up that's kind of interesting to me in the article, a trend that's been overwhelming to me as a young parent, but the trend of the gender reveal party. Mm-hmm. For people who aren't familiar, sketch out what those are and why that can be problematic to start with gender before birth.
Sure. So gender reveal parties are kind of a new version of a baby shower that some people do, and there's tons of YouTube videos where you can watch them. I watched a lot of them when I was writing this. But it's basically a party for your family and friends where the parents, the expectant parents, don't yet know the gender, the sex of their child. And so there's kind of this big reveal moment, and there's lots of different ways of doing it. There's, you know, you see like two parents like untying a giant box, and the box opens and pink balloons float out or blue balloons float out, or there's like a, you know, hitting a golf ball on a golf course and the ball like explodes and all this colorful pigment comes out. But one way or another, it's basically like a big dramatic display where the sex of the child is revealed to both the parents of that child and their whole community. And it's fun, you know, it's fun to watch. It's really usually really jubilant. And I definitely noticed it seemed to me that when it was a boy, kind of all the focus went to the dad and how excited the dad must be to have a boy coming. And when it was a girl, you know, likewise towards the mom, not always. To me, you know, I think that it's really setting up kind of a path for those parents to follow and for the family to follow. I'm sure after those parties, the next thing that happens is that, you know, if it's a girl, a bunch of like dresses and headbands get delivered, you know, everyone knows what gift to buy or what color to paint the nursery or what, you know, all those kinds of things are suddenly sort of like guided by this bit of information. And on one hand, I think it makes a lot of sense because, you know, when a person is pregnant, there's so little that you can know about what's happening in there. You can't know much about how the baby's doing. I mean, of course, there are lots of good tests and things, and you can get a basic idea, but it's so mysterious. And it although it's an exciting time, it can be a time filled with anxiety as you wait to know if this baby's going to be healthy and what they're going to be like. And so knowing the sex is like this one definitive bit of information that everyone can kind of cling to and feel like now we know this thing. And it's a bit, in a way, I think it provides like a happy distraction while you wait out the rest of the pregnancy. You can, you know, busy yourself with all of these things. But it does set up very, very early. In fact, before the child comes into the world, it sets up an expectation of what they are and what they're not in certain ways that are pretty fundamental. And that becomes like a roadmap that I think this child ultimately has very little agency in, you know, because until they're a few years into life, they really have no say in whether they want to be that directly identified with these certain signifiers.
So last year, Boy Scouts of America opened admission to girls, girl members, and Girl Scouts has not made a similar move to open admission to boys. What's going on there, and why do you think that's so significant?
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of goes back to what I was saying a little bit earlier about the idea that I think, you know, the qualities that we consider to be traditionally boys and then men's are qualities that we're currently still really upholding in the world. And that's because there are a lot of there's real validation that comes. So to be more specific about that, you know, girls empowerment right now surrounds in a lot of ways telling girls you can be anything in the world. And that means, of course, you can be what girls and women have always been. You know, caretakers, nurturers, those types of roles. You can also be what men have always been. You can be an astronaut. You can be president. You can be the, you know, executive of a big company, all these things. And many of the qualities that are reinforced in childhood in order to set the path in that direction are things like, you know, assertiveness and courage and bravery and strength. And I don't want to be misunderstood as saying that those are only men's qualities, but those are qualities that are being kind of reinforced across the board for both boys and girls as a way of saying this is a good thing to be in the world.
And now, go ahead.
So go ahead.
No, I was saying, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts are kind of structured differently, and we're not really nudging boys towards caretaking, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So basically in the Boy Scouts, you know, so I think there was an outcry from parents of girls saying our girls want to be in the Boy Scouts because they might be more into what's available to them in the Boy Scouts, or they might respond better to what's being encouraged in the Boy Scouts. And, you know, when the Scouts decided that Boy Scouts was going to be open to all, there's an article in which a parent was quoted saying, you know, kind of the Girl Scouts isn't for more rough and tumble girls, was the quote approximately. But, you know, the converse scenario really didn't even have any attention in the media coverage of this. There was nobody saying like, well, Boy Scouts might not really seem like a good fit for a boy who's a little bit more into like, you know, caretaking or whatever you want to say within that category. So it was as if to say nobody would even fathom the idea that a boy would say, I want to be in the Girl Scouts, or that the Girl Scouts might want to say boys can join us. But if you look across, you know, the different badges that you can earn on both sides, I mean, it's still it's very true that the Girl Scout badges lean more towards those what you would consider traditionally like feminine qualities. Thinking about your community, thinking in the collective, doing things for others, this kind of thing. And so to me, what it meant was we're still saying it's more okay to lean towards these traditionally boyish occupations and characteristics and qualities than it is to go in the other direction. And that a boy who might express a desire for that is still going to feel like they shouldn't, and like it's shameful or it's embarrassing or someone's going to say no.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. And you make a really interesting point that we're kind of oppressing both genders when we live this way. How so?
Yeah, because I think we're still implicitly saying that these qualities that we consider to be feminine qualities don't measure up. They're not as valued in the world. And we don't think, I mean, if we think that you know, it's embarrassing for a boy to like beautiful things, you know, or to express certain like feminine characteristics that are already within themselves, or to imitate feminine qualities that they see around them, or to like certain things that are associated with femininity. I mean, if we're still saying that that's an embarrassing thing to do, and yet we're telling girls if they, you know, imitate sort of masculine qualities they see in the world, that that's like really cool and, you know, that that means they're strong. Well, then we're not telling kids that both of those things are equal. We're telling kids that only half of these things are things that you should aspire towards and freely demonstrate. And these other things, if you're a boy, you should kind of keep that under wraps because people are going to tell you it's not okay.
Let's take a call now. We're going to go to Aaron in East Texas. Aaron, go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me on here. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. So I guess the first one is overall, is the objective here to get rid of a definition of a gender and just have a neutrality type human? is what this conversation is seems to be leading to. So I guess that's my first question.
Do you want to go ahead with your second? We don't have too much time before the break. So what's your second part?
And the second one is for the foundation. I have a 2-year-old son, and I feel like it would damage him more to grow up and have to juggle between masculinity and femininity instead of, so there's a juggling force. Well, I am biology a man, but I have feminine tendencies. Instead of steward that into a place, no, son, you are a male, and you will have and are called to have more masculine tendencies. I'm not saying that he has to be Rambo, but I'm not going to steward his life into the point to where, you know, he's just seeking femininity, because then he will be faced one day with, well, I'm a male, but I act like a female.
What do you think about that?
I think those are great questions, really, really good questions. I don't want to sound like I'm saying we should eliminate gender. It's a complicated conversation, and I think what I personally feel as the mother of a boy, and also just as I've done a lot of research on this, it's more, what's significant to me about this isn't whether or not a boy wears a dress. You know, that's, some boys are going to want to, others are not. I don't think we need to encourage all boys to do that necessarily. I don't know that I would have a boy who wears a dress if he hadn't made very clear that that was a thing he really was interested in. But I think, to me, the real problem has to do with the ways that coding these things so strictly at an early age leads to potentially adult men who feel like they weren't allowed to be their full selves. I mean, I guess that's it. I think there's going to be a wide spectrum of how much a little boy wants to express feminine or masculine, as we're currently terming them, you know, qualities. Not all boys are going to want are going to like a princess or whatever it is. I don't think everyone has to be every way. I think what we need is the option for all individual children to self-express in the way that feels right for them. And I think if we prevent that, we're setting ourselves up for a culture of adult men, some of whom are going to be suppressed in some way and potentially angry or suffering as a result. And that is where we suffer as a culture.
My guest this hour is Sarah Rich, who wrote an article for The Atlantic called Today's Masculinity is Stifling. The number to call is 800-933-5372. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sarah Rich, who wrote a piece for The Atlantic called Today's Masculinity is Stifling. So, Sarah, what does it mean to be gender nonconforming?
I think the term is used now for both boys and girls who, you know, don't fall directly in line with what's considered to match up to their gender. So, you know, for a boy wearing a dress is considered gender nonconforming because, traditionally, to conform to masculine gender norms means not wearing dresses. There are equivalents for girls as well. I mean, there are other terms. There's gender expansive, which I kind of like a little bit more than gender nonconforming, in part because it doesn't define it according to what it's not, and also because it kind of enables this sense of expansiveness, you know, something a little bit more broad. But gender nonconforming is a term that's pretty widely used.
Do you think people confuse transgender with gender nonconforming and assume if there's any toe outside of the box that we've drawn around boys and girls, that must mean that something is biologically different and they have to take action in that direction?
Well, I think that it can be true that when a child doesn't conform to their gender norm, that they're that the, depending on their context, that people in their lives can assume that they must want to be the other gender. Yeah, I mean, I do think that that can happen. I think in some cases, it's people with the best of intentions of being accepting of the nonconforming behavior, the response of saying, oh, maybe you're gender questioning, that you maybe you're trans. I mean, I think that that can emerge in an attempt to be like open to the nonconforming behaviors. But I also think it's sometimes a way of trying to find a certainty where there's ambiguity. A lot of the time, especially with little kids, I mean, part of what's going on is just they don't know yet or feel yet that they need to conform, and they're experimenting with what they think they are. And so to immediately jump to some, you know, to a trans identity as what's going on, I think sometimes that can happen before it's necessarily appropriate. And I think the ways that trans kids express their desire to be the gender other than the one they were assigned at birth, I think that that manifests pretty differently a lot of the time in kids who are trans and who know they're trans young than kids who are simply experimenting with gender expression.
And do sometimes just kids like what they like? I mean, I can think of an example. My four-year-old was at a toy store recently. He was allowed to pick one or two small things as a result of a long incentive system we had developed in our home. And what he chose was a very, very dark Batman figure and then a pink bear with like really glittery paws. And he just liked them both. I mean, there was, I didn't really think much of it because who wouldn't be drawn to either of those if you like Batman? And I mean, pink sparkles are great to look at. Do you think that we steer kids away from things like this too often? Because it just doesn't seem like what we're supposed to be letting them buy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've thought about this at times in the pediatrician's office. I have a boy and a girl. My girl's two. And even, you know, when they're babies and they get their vaccines, you know, the boys get like a Batman Band-Aid and the girls get a princess Band-Aid. And it's so harmless in a way that that's how it goes. And yet it's so also stunning in a way that we're like, oh, well, this, you know, based on the genitalia of this infant, we're going to decide which Band-Aid is most appropriate to put on their little thigh. You know, it's really, it's just from, I guess what I'm saying is it comes from everywhere that we're already telling kids, this is what's for you and this is what's not for you. And it can be innocuous and at times, but I think the accumulation of it ultimately often is not.
Let's take another call now. We're going to go to Moises in San Antonio. Moises, go ahead with your question.
So it was just a comment. I think sometimes we take these things too serious, but gender is a very fluid thing that changes with time. I'm in my early 60s, and when I was going to high school, we were trained to do radios and carpentry, and we never were trained to do cooking or typing, and now in my life it's much more important to type or cook, and I didn't get the opportunity because it was felt at that time that my gender would not be favored with that. And I think things are changing so much that I think they should have the opportunity to experiment, as long as nobody's forcing any, you know, unconscious agenda. I think it's more a relaxed concept that people should have the options to choose what they want.
So do you think we've moved beyond home ec for the girls, woodshop for the boys? Are we losing out on skills because we're trying to funnel people based on gender?
Well, it's probably less divided in the way that he describes, you know, and but I do still think, I mean, I actually, there are several organizations here that are sort of girls empowerment organizations that teach girls things like, you know, welding and carpentry and engineering and things like that. You know, and obviously there's a huge move to have STEM be something that girls are, you know, excelling in as much as boys. But for, you know, typing, for example, is a good one, or computers in general. I mean, obviously it's clear that everybody needs to know those things now. So part of it is just, you know, there are other factors changing in our lives that change what people need. But you still don't see a lot. There was a great interactive piece in the New York Times last year, I think, or maybe earlier this year, about men in caretaking positions, particularly in nursing. And it you know, a lot of these men who are nurses were quoted talking about what it feels like to enter this profession and how people respond to them. And, you know, it's still, again, very much more the case that men who show up in traditionally female occupations kind of get like unexpected responses or get looked at sideways or get questioned for their motivations for wanting to do those kinds of things. I mean, it's just the pace of attitude change around it is slow.
And I've noticed a lot with men who are caring for children, they get a lot more comments from people like, uh-oh, daddy daycare, or something along the lines of, you must be giving mom a break, which just basically implies that you're filling in this duty instead of an equal partner as a caretaker.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my husband has remarked about how easy it is to get accolades in public when you're with your kids. Like, just being with your kids is enough to have strangers congratulate you, you know, whereas like a mother standing in a grocery store with a crying child is, you know, seen as somehow they're failing. But the father would probably be like a hero just for standing with the child, even if the child's, you know, throwing a fit. So I think there's kind of a funny response that you can really recognize when you're out in public.
You wrote a bit in the article about how there are several books out now for children about, for example, boys who like to wear dresses, but all of them involve quite a bit of conflict for the resolution to come. Tell me a little bit about why that trope bothers you and kind of what you learned as you explored that.
Yeah. Yeah, I picked up some books when it became clear that the dress wearing was something my son was really, into and committed to, for at least for now. And there are books out there about boys in dresses, and, you know, they're boys who like pink and princesses and various, you know, whatever the different pieces are of that puzzle. And most of them are set up in a way where, you know, this boy does something, again, we can use the term non-conforming, and then his friends or his parents or his teachers or somebody around him says, that's not for you, you shouldn't do that, and shames them, and there's some suffering involved. And you know, in many of them, the result is then that the boy goes home and is very sad and despondent, doesn't want to go to school because the kids are going to tease him at school. And, you know, ultimately it resolves where the kid wears his dress and he goes to school and the kids decide, okay, we're going to accept you for who you are, and, you know, has a happy ending. For me, what's hard about that is I guess I've found myself not wanting to read this narrative to my kid that suffering is going to be an inevitable part of choosing not to conform to these what I view as pretty narrow standards for him. You know, yes, he has experienced some teasing, but I would not say he has experienced, and I hope he will not experience, you know, really terrible bullying. Now, I think the reason these books exist is for kids who have experienced bullying or who've experienced the teasing as a more difficult experience to say this might happen and a happy outcome is possible. So I understand why those books exist, but I think for kids who haven't experienced that, or for kids who are totally outside of this experience for themselves but are just reading that book, I think it sets up an expectation that that's how this is going to play out. And I guess I find myself not wanting to say this is how it's going to go out in the world necessarily. So my favorite book that came out in May is called Julian is a Mermaid, and it's about a little boy who wants to dress up as a mermaid, and that book contains just unconditional love. His grandmother is the main character in the book with him, and she just accepts him, and I found that to be pretty revolutionary, because most of the books before there's acceptance, there's this barrier to love.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. And interestingly enough, I know you pushed back on one of the authors and asked, you know, why include, you know, the ridicule and the derision. And, you know, he said that's unfortunately life in the real world. But we've had school districts banning children's books like this, right?
Yeah. So this book called Jacob's New Dress was written by Sarah and Ian Hoffman. And I talked with Ian, and I said to him sort of like, in that book, you know, Jacob, yes, he experiences teasing. He gets sad. The kids kind of try to reform him, and then they stop trying to reform him and they accept him. And I said, why does it have to be like this? And he said, well, that's reality, and kids are smart and they know what reality is like. And he said, you know, we hoped that our book would very quickly become quaint. In other words, that people would say, why was there even a book about this conflict? Because the conflict will go away culturally. And then in North Carolina, public school district was going to use that book as one of the books in a sort of study unit about difference. And the book was banned. That happened very recently. And And the comment from the school district was, you know, something along the lines of like, you know, this was going to create problems, or I don't remember exactly what the statement was. It's in my article. Yeah, I mean, for that, the book is a book about difference. There's no question about that. And it's a book about how difference is experienced by children. And that's what the unit of inquiry was meant to be about. And yet something triggered the people in the school district, or the people in, you know, I don't know if it was parents or the teachers or where it began, but ultimately the choice was made to cut that book out. So I think in some ways it's just like, that's how uncomfortable this makes people. You know, we can talk about lots of other types of difference and lots of other types of ways, I guess, but that's not going to be one of them. I find that pretty stunning.
And it's hard to imagine if the book was called, you know, Lily's New Firefighter Costume, where Lily goes to work without makeup, nobody would really think twice about it.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, the double standard is so apparent in that. I mean, there are lots of books about girls who want to, you know, be scientists or whatever it is that we think is sort of pushing the boundaries of what girls have been allowed to be. And those books are celebrated.
Do you think we'll ever get there, you know, where it's cool for little boys to wear a skirt to school or like My Little Ponies? Is that ahead for us?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I will say, you know, my son hangs out with very typically boyish boys and he hangs out with girls. And in his life right now, the way he presents himself doesn't cause any of those kids to bat an eye. You know, they may have at first, and now they don't. And some of them never did. Some of them just don't even think about it. So I guess in my little sort of microcosm anecdotal experience, I would say I think it is possible, but that's on a very individual basis. I mean, I think on a wide stream, or, you know, on a broad level, it's going to take a lot more than just individuals. I mean, I will go back to saying, like, I think the consumer culture piece of this is really huge. I think until toy manufacturers and marketers change the way that they design and package and market toys, we're pretty stuck in it. And that's the same for clothing, and that's the same for books and entertainment. I mean, I think those are big areas where if that doesn't start to change and the message changes, then we're boxing ourselves in.
And this is a big question for what's very nearly the end of the show, but how can we kind of expand our definition of masculinity?
Well, I mean, I think, I've probably said it already, but, you know, I think for little kids, I think the way to expand it is simply to just, I don't think we need to start as early as we do kind of defining what's boy and what's girl. I mean, the basic definitions are going to be clear to little children because they're anatomical. Like, there's no question with that. But I think beyond that, you know, kids don't have a sexuality, sexual identity until they're much older. So there's this arena during early childhood, I think, where we're putting a lot of that on kids kind of for no reason. I think a big solution early on is just to let kids just be kids. A kid doesn't have to be anything other than a kid for like the first 10 years of life, really, for the most part, beyond the pieces of their gender that they already kind of know themselves.
My guest this hour was Sarah Rich. Her piece in The Atlantic is called Today's Masculinity is Stifling. Sarah, thank you so much for your time. It's been such an interesting conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer, with help on the boards today from Alan Roberts. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.